For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It is August the 25th. We are in Parashat Mishpatim. We're on page 418. We'll start from Pasuk Hey, verse 5. Page 418. So last time we covered the case of the Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave, meaning a Jew who is either sold or sells himself to another Jew. And we discussed some of the terms of his slavery, 6 years, and we talked about whether his master can give him a non-Jewish, or as we said, not really non-Jewish, but somewhere in the middle kind of situation, but a shivcha, a non-Jewish slave, to produce more slaves for him. And now, we read this last time, we're going to read it again now. What if the slave wants to stay longer? The Jewish slave wants to stay longer. So let's read these two verses. If the slave says, I loved my master, my wife, my children, I do not want to go out free. Clearly he's referring to not his Jewish wife and Jewish children. He's referring to the wife and children who will have to stay with the master, because they are those that were owned by the master. His master will bring him close to the court. Bring him close to the door or to the doorpost. And his master will pierce his ear with an awl. And he'll be his slave forever. Now, let's clarify a few things over here to understand what the verse actually means. So we mentioned last time that when it says li'olam, it does not mean forever, it means up until Yovel. Yovel is the 50th year, and this means up until Yovel. The way we know that is because in Parshas Behar later on, the Torah is going to tell us that at Yovel, you have to let all slaves go free. That's a law in the Torah, that all slaves go free at the Yovel year. So if all slaves go free at the Yovel year, how could it be that this man is his slave forever? We don't have slaves forever. So it must be, then, that it doesn't mean forever, it means for a period of time that is considered to be forever. 50 years is considered to be a significant enough time that it's called le'olam, forever. So it's only until the Yovel that he remains a slave, even if he gets his ear pierced, which means he wants to be a slave. He wants to be with the master, but it is only until 50 years that he can, till the 50th year of the, till Yovel. When it says that you bring him close to the door or to the doorpost, the Gemara, the Talmud tells us that the actual way that it's done is that the ear is placed up against the door, and then the awl pierces through the ear and into the door. That's the method it's done. Not the door post, but the door. Not the door post. Why does it say door post? Because it's to tell us that the door has to be standing connected to the door post. It can't be a door that's been detached. It has to be an actual door that's functioning as a working door. The Gemara and the Medrash discuss why is it that the piercing of the ear is done with a door and a doorpost. And why pierce the ear at all? What's the symbolism of piercing the ear? So the Medrash tells us that this Jew heard at Har Sinai, at Mount Sinai, that we are slaves to Hashem. And he went and sold himself to another Jew. This ear has to be pierced, because the ear, he is not listening to what he heard at Mount Sinai. Or if it's a case where he was sold into slavery because he stole money and could not repay. Then, it's a similar idea. This same ear that heard at Har Sinai, do not steal, and he went and stole, so again, it is the ear that gets pierced. So, even though the Torah does sanction slavery, for in this case, for the person who sells himself to slavery or stole and gets sold into slavery, but we are being told very clearly it is not an ideal. It is only under certain circumstances that it is recognized, but it is not an ideal that a Jew is a slave to a fellow Jew. The word marzea means all. A-W-L, right? And all. Marzea. The numerical value of marzea, if you look at that word, it's the third to last word in Pasuk Vav in verse 6. Ba marzea, with and all. So the word marzea is mem, resh, tzadi, and aleph. Those are the four letters. Mem's numerical value is 40. We need you math whizzes now to add it up as I go. Mem is 40. Resh is 200. That's 240. Tzadi is 90. That's 330. And ayin is 70. 400. So the Baal HaTorim writes that this, that Hashem put us through slavery for 400 years. From the time of the Bris Ben Abisarim, from the time of the covenant that Hashem had with Abraham, it says that your children will be in a land not their own for 400 years. So we went through that already. And then Hashem took us out. And He took us out to be subjects of His, not to be slaves to fellow Jews. So for a Jew who goes and wants to be a slave, he says, I want to stay with my master, he needs to have the marzea, the awl, bore his ear into the door as symbolism that he is not really following the ideal. Yeah.
Does it say somewhere in the oral Torah or something which ear gets pierced?
The right ear.
The right is the one I would get.
Yeah, it's the right ear. Yeah, that's also derived from various things, but yeah, it's the right ear. Yeah.
Why not the left ear?
It's derived from various sources of ear. Yeah.
Yeah. So why do we have the custom, to this day for little girls to pierce their ears?
A woman cannot, this designation is called a nirtza. You have, let me tell you the Hebrew terms. You have an Eved Ivri, which means a Jewish slave. Then we have an Amma Ivriya, which is a female Jewish slave. We haven't learned about that yet. That's the next discussion. And then we have a category called Nirtza. Nirtza means he's had his ear pierced. That's what we just learned about now. That the slave says, I want to stay longer. Only a man can become a Nirtza. A woman cannot. Only a man can choose to remain a slave until the Yovel. A woman, as we're going to see, the whole institution of a Jewess being a slave to a Jew, that entire institution is completely different, and there is no basis for her remaining a slave any longer than the prescribed time. Therefore, pierced ears for a woman is not a sign of slavery, because a woman cannot be a nirtza. Even if she would have her ear pierced, it would not make her stay longer. It's only for a man where the symbolism of the pierced ear connotes slavery.
And if he has a family, they're not released.
A man, a Jewish man who has a Jewish wife and children,
yes,
they are supported by the master as long as he's a slave.
Yeah.
And then when he leaves, he goes back to them and the master doesn't support them anymore. If the master gives him a slave woman while he is under terms of slavery, for the purpose of producing more slaves, they remain with the master.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, that's
the mistake. Yeah.
Right. Now, that's all. So far, we dealt with a man, a Jewish man, who either stole money and now needs to somehow find money to pay back, so he's sold into slavery, or a Jewish man who is destitute and sells himself in order to get some money to support his family, and he remains for 6 years. And if he wants to remain longer, we discourage the practice, but if he wants to, he can until the Yovel. Of course, his master has to want to keep him. As we mentioned last time, it's a rather expensive proposition to keep a slave. It's pretty onerous. Okay, what about a female? So the concept of a Jewish woman, or actually girl, being a slave, is not only are the laws different, but as we will read, the intent is completely different. We have to keep that in mind. Let's read it. We'll see. Pasuk Vav, verse 6. V'chi yimkor ish es bito le'amah. If a man will sell his daughter as a maid. Now already you see, we're not dealing with a woman selling herself. We're dealing with a father selling his daughter. It's a completely different approach. Lo seitzei kitzeso avodim. She does not go out as the slaves go out, which means she doesn't go free as the slaves go free. Now, what that means, one may have been tempted to read this as, she does not go free, she remains a maid and cannot leave the master forever. However, that is not true. In fact, as we will see, a Jewish girl has more methods of becoming free than a Jewish man. A Jewish man can only go free after 6 years, or if somehow he is bought out of slavery. Since he has no money, he can't afford to buy himself out. But let's say he inherits money while he's a slave. He could then buy his way out. Or someone else could buy him out. So those are ways of getting out. But other than that, he's stuck until year six. After year six, he goes out. A Jewish girl also has those two methods available to her, either 6 years or she can buy herself out or be bought out. Being bought out does not mean that one becomes a slave to the person who bought them out. Being bought out means someone benevolently gives money and the person goes free. You can't sell a Jewish slave to another owner. If you purchase a Jewish slave, it's yours till 6 years and that's it. There's no bartering, no selling, you can't go selling them around. So the Jewish girl has the same methods of getting out as the Jewish man, which is either 6 years or buying herself out or someone else buying her out, as we'll see. And in fact, she even has another way of getting out besides that, which we'll see in a moment. But when it says here, she shall not go out like the slaves go out, there's two meanings. The halachic meaning the according to the law, this is referring to she does not go out of slavery the same way that non-Jewish slaves go out of slavery. We mentioned last time that non-Jewish slaves, which are not being discussed over here, if they are mistreated by the master, they go free. Specifically, if the master strikes the non-Jewish slave, then depending on how badly he hurts his slave, the slave will go free under certain circumstances. So if he knocks out a tooth, the slave goes free. If he blinds an eye, the slave goes free. If he severs a finger, the slave goes free. These are safeguards that we have in place that one cannot mistreat even his non-Jewish slaves. Now, you have to appreciate that nowhere on the face of the earth did they have such treatment for slaves. It is only among the Jews that we treated slaves that way. That you could not beat up your slave, because if you did, your slave went free. That was true for non-Jewish slaves. For Jewish slaves, that rule does not apply. Why does it not apply to Jewish slaves? Because Jewish slaves are full-fledged citizens, and they can take you to court, and they can sue you for damages, like any other Jew. And therefore, if the Jewish owner beats up his Jewish slave or maid, they get paid full compensation like any other Jew. So there is no, that's what it means over here. She will not go free for being beaten because she's a regular Jewess. If he got free to beat her, first of all, he's going to have to pay huge damages. Second of all, he will be taken to task by court for beating somebody. Like anybody else, if anybody beats anybody up, they get punished by the court. A master has no right to beat anybody. So the she will not go free if, God forbid, he would knock out her tooth. That's the literal meaning of what's going on over here. But there's a deeper meaning than that. And that is that when a man sells his daughter for a slave, the purpose is that she not go free. The purpose is that she remains forever with the master. How could that be? What do you mean she remains forever the master? We just said after 6 years she goes free. And that is because, as we're about to read, the purpose of selling a daughter into slavery was not for slavery. It was rather to give her a chance to marry into a family that would be able to support her. That was the purpose. You have a girl. How much work can a girl do anyway? Why would anybody buy a 7, 8, 9-year-old girl? How much work can she do? If you want to buy somebody, buy a 21-year-old male. He'll do a lot of work for you, right? He'll be out in the field, right? What are you going to buy a girl, as we're about to see, this is only for a girl under bas mitzvah. So what are you going to do with a 7, 8, 9-year-old girl? Okay, she'll do some sewing for you. I don't know what she's going to do. She's going to do the dishes. What is she going to do exactly? There's not much that she can do. She can watch the kids. I mean, she can nanny for you. I mean, there's not much she can do. So the main purpose in this is you have a man who has no money. He can't support his family. And he has no recourse. And he says to himself the following: I can't support my family. My daughter is going to grow up and no one will marry her because I have no dowry to give her. She is going to go out into the world and be stuck. And she has no way of improving her lot. And here we have a nice family, a wonderful family, that is willing to adopt her. But not adopt her in that way. I mean, she has living parents. What do you mean adopt her? But they're willing to give me money, and they'll give me money, and she will become a member of their family. She will have work to do. She will now be answerable to her, we'll call him a stepfather, to this man, who will, he can't hurt her. After all, first of all, the courts will be on his back, and second of all, I'll be on his back. I'm her father. He can't hurt her. He can't mistreat her. She will become a contributing member of that family, but it will be contractual. It won't just be, well, because he feels like it. It will be contractual. He'll actually get paid, which means once he pays, he's obligated, just as I'm obligated, just as she must stay with him. So it's a two-way street. But at the same time, he now is locked himself in to have her. And the purpose ultimately is that either he or his son marries this girl. That's the ultimate purpose. That when she gets older, either he or his son will marry her. And the money that was given to the father will now turn into, retroactively, the wedding money. As we know, when a man puts a ring on a woman's finger, that's wedding money. That's called kesef. That's one way of making a marriage, is to give money to the kala, to the bride. Here, the money is being given to the father of the bride, which is the way anyway marriage takes place when a girl is underage. When there were marriages for girls underage, which was a rare occurrence, but when it did happen, the money was given to her father. And that's what's happening here as well. So that it's not slavery in the sense we hear the word slavery and we get very uptight about it. This is a completely different arrangement. The point over here was to set up a foster family while her parents are still alive and set her up for her future so she will have a marriage down the line that will be in a family that can support her where she can be a contributing member. And that's why it says, Lo seitzei kitzei sa'avadim, she should not go out as the slaves go out, which means it's not the same system. The slave, the male slave, he's a slave. He remains a slave until the term is up and he leaves. Because there the purpose is get whatever money he has to get and then get out. With her the purpose is get her set up so that she'll have a place for her the rest of her life. Let's read a little further. Im ra'a b'einei adoneha, Pasuk Ches, verse 8. Im ra'a b'einei adoneha, if she is bad in the eyes of her master, which means she doesn't find favor in his eyes, asher lo ye'ada, that he does not marry her, right? And you see the default is he should marry her. But if, for whatever reason, he doesn't want to marry her, vehefda, or he doesn't find a way for her to buy herself out, she doesn't have any money to buy herself out, there's no method of doing that, then, first of all, le'am nachri lo yimshol l'machra b'vigova. First of all, to a foreign nation, here the word nation means another family. to a foreign nation, he may not rule over her to sell her in his rebellion against her. What rebellion against her? How did he rebel against her? This is her master who purchased her as a maid, and he doesn't want to marry her, and there's no way for her to buy herself out. He may not sell her to another family in his rebellion to her. What rebellion? The rebellion is that he's not marrying her, because the purpose ultimately was to set her up for marriage. And when the master, as we'll see, either him or his son, doesn't marry her, they are rebelling against her. And the Torah makes it clear they may not sell her. She goes free at that point. Let's read a little further. Vim livno yiodena, if to his son he betroths her, kemishpat habanos yasela, then it's done to her like all the other daughters, which means she's treated like a regular wife. And all the obligations and contractual rules that there are between a husband and wife apply to her as well. If either the master or the son who married her then marries another wife, as you know, it's permitted from the Torah for a man to have more than one wife, if he will take this woman and then another woman as a wife, then he must maintain all the obligations of a husband to a wife. She'ira, ksusa, ve'onasa, lo yigra. The three major obligations of a husband to a wife are she'ira, which is her food, ksusa, her clothing and shelter, va'unasa, which literally means her time, which is referring to the marital intimacy, lo yigra, he may not detract from her. She has to get her fair share of all of the contractual obligations that a husband has to a wife. V'im shlosh eila lo yasela, and if these three things are not done for her, v'yatza chinam, she goes out for free, ein kasef, there is no money. She just leaves for free. We'll explain that in a moment. I'll take a stop, pause for questions, but the she remains a slave, a girl who was sold by her father. She remains a slave until one of, I guess you can call it, five things happen. Either 6 years pass and she goes free, or she is bought out, either she, you know, by her own money or someone else's money, then she goes free, or the master or his son marry her. That's another way. Or she becomes of age. When she turns 12 years old, she goes free for nothing. She leaves the master's place for nothing. So that when a man purchases a young girl, again, how much work are we talking about? And when she's just reaching an age where she may have a lot of work in her, she goes free. So we're not talking about an investment here of like we are with the man. With the man, we're talking about a real investment. It cost me a lot of money to buy him because I got to support him and his wife and kids, but he may actually be a big help in the field. He's a big strapping guy. I can use that kind of work, and he works for me. It's like having an employee that there's a lot of benefits. Meaning I have to give a lot of benefits. I got to support his wife and kids. Okay, that's what it costs to have an employee, and he can't quit. I have some job security. I have an employee who cannot quit for 6 years. Okay, that sets me up with this guy, which is good. I got my field plowed. His family is taken care of for 6 years. And, you know, that works well for me. And he can't quit. That's what he loses, the ability to quit. But he needed it. So clearly, it's a purchase for commercial reasons. That's the reason to purchase the male. The female, if you're doing it for commercial reasons, you're not going to get much out of it. The purpose of it is that I see this man has a daughter. She is a daughter who appears to be someone who will make a good wife. Either if I'm very young, it'll be for me, most likely for my son, and I think it'll be a good shidduch. She comes from a family with nothing. I want to ensure, I like what I see, I think she's a nice person, I think she has good midos, I think it'll be a good shidduch. I want to ensure that she be set up with my son, so I'm willing to invest now for that. And on the other side, they're looking for a way to set her up, because otherwise she might end up with nobody. and so I give money to the father. Now this money right now is only going to be to purchase as if she were a slave, because in the end it's not an obligation to marry. So I'm not marrying her right this second. I'm giving the money now, which for the time being is a purchase price, but later the intent is that it will turn into a marriage. And she enters my family. She will now be a productive member of my family, just like my kids have to set the table. She has to set the table. She can't tell me no, even though I'm not her father, because she has a contractual obligation. She has to set the table. She has to vacuum the floor. She, just like everybody else, she has to do this. Just like all my other kids have to. She has to help my wife in the kitchen. Whatever else that I have my 7, 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old girls do, that's what she has to do. But the point eventually is going to be to set her up for marriage, either with me or with my son. That's the goal. If, when she reaches 12 years old, at that point, I need to make a decision, either for me or for my son. And at that point, when she's already entering the age of adulthood, we are not interested, then that's it. She goes free. And there's no payback. She just walks out of the arrangement. And that's it. She's a free girl, and she chooses her on her own what she wants to do. Yes.
Okay, so obviously she doesn't have a choice.
No.
If they want her, she's got to marry one of them.
Yes, but bear in mind that according to the Torah, a father can marry off his daughter without her consent at a young age.
Yeah.
Now, we don't recommend it, but it can be done.
Okay, then also, if this master who is buying her, so to speak, and his purpose is really to make a shidduch either with himself or his son, why can't he just give the family the money and let the child live with her own family?
Right. So I suspect that that is in fact what happened many times. Meaning, what it did is it obligated both sides.
Mm-hmm.
When I gave the money, it means I'm essentially putting her on hold. You can't set her up with anybody else until she turns 12.
Correct.
That means I have first dibs.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So I suspect, because if you think about it, it's difficult. Why, for me to bring her into my home, and then she needs to learn, in many cases it might be a lot easier, let her stay there. Right? On the other hand, what if they can't feed her? What if she's living in a house with rats and the roof is leaking out? She might want, you never know the situation. So it depends on the case. But I suspect that happened often.
Okay, and the other thing is, you said 6 years. Is that the maximum?
That's the maximum.
For a man or...
Yes,
anybody.
But with a girl, because it ends at 12 anyway, it almost never happened, because the purchase would usually be at a little bit older age, and then there aren't 6 years left.
Okay, so if somebody, so I'm wondering about this 50-year.
That's only for the man at the end of the 6 years. He says, "I want to stay longer."
Okay.
That's the only way we can go longer than 6 years.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Rabbi, are there no restrictions on, for instance, a single young male buying a young girl?
Excellent question. Okay. So Herman is actually asking an excellent question, and let's develop that a little bit.
Yes.
Okay? Let me develop it, because I wanted to get into this anyway.
Yes.
It is important to note that as far as the Torah is concerned, we are extremely sensitive to the threat of molestation. That is something which we do not take lightly at all. And as a result, we never, ever put a young female under the control of anyone except her father, any male except her father, unless she gets married. Then she's with her husband. But she needs to be spoken for either by her father or her husband, or she's on her own. But we never, ever, ever put her under the control of a male figure who is neither her father nor her husband. This is the only exception, and it's because the purpose is to ultimately be her husband. Right? Now, I want you to understand that this is what is missed in the discussion of when in Israel, the discussion of females in the military, this is the point that is not discussed openly. And that is that when it's well known that the religious Jews in Israel do not want females in the military.
Right.
It's well known. And it's well known that it's a modesty issue. And we understand that there is a modesty issue because you have men and women and they're in the military and all kinds of other stuff go on. But what is missed is the following. The military is not a regular employer. A regular employer, as we said last time, the major difference between being a slave and being an employee, really in some ways the only difference between a slave and being an employee, a Jewish slave, and being an employee, is an employee can quit. And that is a right that the Torah guarantees. An employee can always walk away from a job. They'll lose their money, but they can always walk away from a job. You cannot force anybody to stay as your employee, except a slave. A slave loses the right to quit. That's the difference. The military, you cannot quit. You are under the control of your superior, and you cannot walk away. You get court-martialed if you walk away. You're punished for walking away. You can't. So when you have females in the military who are under the direct control of a male, you have now put a woman in a position which is very, very dangerous both ways. Which means you either put a woman in a very compromised position where he can force her into things that she wouldn't want to do because he can threaten her and she can't quit. That's one possibility. And the other possibility is that she can use promiscuity to get things out of her superior. Mm-hmm. And that goes on as well. And that's the real problem with females in the military. It's not so much that you have men and women together. You have men and women together in all kinds of jobs. I mean, it's not just the military. But with the military, aside from the fact the military, it's more intimate because you have they're actually, you know, you're living someplace. But aside from that issue, you are putting women under the direct control of a man, and they cannot quit. Now, theoretically, you can get around that by having an all-women detail with only women as officers. So in theory, you can get around that problem. But they don't do that. They don't have... It's so regimented that, you know, you have a woman general followed by a woman captain, and you know, they don't, a lieutenant, you don't have all that all the way down the line. At a certain point in the hierarchy, you're going to hit a man. And at that point, you now have a woman under the control of a man who is neither her father nor her husband. And that we reject categorically. To have such an arrangement, we reject. Here, the only reason why it's acceptable is because the purpose is marriage. So Herman is asking, but if you have a single man who is now going to purchase an 8, 9, 10, 11-year-old girl, aren't we setting up a situation of promiscuity, of molestation, of who knows what, right? Which is a very, very good question. So the answer to that question is that it does not say it in the Torah. But we know that it doesn't say it in regard to this particular case. But we know there are rules of yichud, of seclusion. There is a rule in the Torah of seclusion. You're not allowed, a man is not allowed to be alone with a woman who is not related to him. Who is not his wife, not his daughter, not his mother. There's a woman who he is not related to. He is not allowed to be alone with that woman in seclusion. Now, how do we define seclusion? What does that mean, seclusion? Does that mean I can't go into... a woman wants to speak to me. A woman from the community wants to have a meeting. I can't have a meeting with her. Like, what am I supposed to do? You can't, right? So what is the definition of seclusion? The definition of seclusion is that they are in a room or a house that is alone and that others either don't have access to that room or won't have access to that room. And therefore, the two of them are left to their own devices. That is prohibited. So, for example, let's give some examples. It would be prohibited for a man and a woman to be alone in a house when there is no expectation that anybody else will enter the home. So that if they're in the house because the man's wife has temporarily left the house or the woman's husband has temporarily left the house, as long as they could come back at any moment, that's no problem, and it happens all the time. That's not an issue. The issue is that either they're not married or that the spouse has left the city and they're not coming home. Then it would be prohibited for the two of them to be alone in the house because that would be yichud, that would be seclusion. Or in an office setting, to be behind a locked door where others are not able to enter, that would also be a problem. And the secular world has finally caught up with us because of lawsuits. It takes, of course, money to make the secular world catch up with us with our forward thinking. But today, that is why you always have any male gynecologist or OBGYN, any of them, will always have a female in the room with them when they're examining. Why? Because they're afraid of a lawsuit. Right? We would have required that from the beginning because we don't allow seclusion. And you can't have a situation where no one else can enter the room. Therapists have the same issue. Male and female, where one is the male, with either the therapist and the client, one is the male, one is the female. So what do? You can't compromise their, what's the rule? Yeah, the treatment, their privacy, by allowing people to walk in. But on the other hand, what about the rules of seclusion? Well, the secular world is catching up to us on that as well, because they now also are concerned about lawsuits. I have a friend who is a male nurse, and he once had the night shift. It goes back many, many years. He once had the night shift, and he realized at one point he had the whole, he had one floor that was his floor for the night. And he realized at one point in the middle of the night that the only patient on the floor was a teenage girl. So he called his superior, who was a female nurse, who was not on duty at the time, and called her and said, "I can't stay here." And she said, "Why not? It's your job." He said, "I can't. I am afraid that this girl could say anything and it would be my word against hers. I can't risk that." His superior was very annoyed with him because she wanted it to be, doesn't matter if you're male or female, it's all the same, why should it be different? But he was right. He was right. You can't risk that, right? In today's day and age, how can you, right? But we Jews have always had that standard that you can't have a situation where men and women are like that. So if you have a single man who wants to purchase a female, the courts are not going to allow it unless there is some arrangement made where he has other women in the house, which is possible. He might have, he might be with his mother, right? Or he might have a sister. Or he might, right? In that situation, they would allow it, but they would not allow a purchase which is going to necessarily set up a situation of seclusion of Yichud.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And you said other women in the house. So if he was living with a man, then it still would be a problem.
Okay, that's a good question. You're asking in the laws of Yichud, of seclusion, what if it's two men or three men? Right, so there are different rules about that depending on the age of the men, the age of the women, how many there are. You're right. Under certain combinations...
I'm just asking the question.
Right. So I don't want to get into all the details of that halacha now, but there are certain combinations that are permitted, certain combinations that are prohibited. So and also it depends whether it's only during the day or overnight. You know, there are all kinds of details in the law. But typically, two adult men and one adult woman during the day is usually permitted. This situation would be a little bit more difficult to permit because you're dealing with a girl who doesn't have she's young, so she doesn't have the same sense of awareness of herself and like that. So we would have to be more careful in this kind of situation. This is the concept of Jewish slavery, meaning a Jew or a Jewess being a quote, I want to say quote unquote slave to somebody else. Because as you see, the comparison to what we in our minds think of as slavery is really not that strong. Now, when we talk later about having non-Jews who are slaves to Jews, that's much closer to our concept of slavery, but much, much, much more humane, as we've already pointed out. For example, they go free if they're beaten. So that's already a sharp departure from what the world at large considers with slavery. No question? No. Now, we're not going to get to the laws of non-Jewish slaves for a while. So I do want to mention to you now one of the other major differences between the way we treated our non-Jewish slaves and the way the world at large treated slaves. we know that we have many laws about relationships between men and women. And we know we're restricted in marrying only Jewish. We know also that within that there are also other laws as well, especially for a Kohen, all kinds of rules in who we can marry, who we can't marry. One of the restrictions with a physical relationship is a slave is prohibited. And therefore, I'm talking about a non-Jewish slave. Therefore, the master was restricted from having any kind of physical relationship with his female slaves. The fact of the matter is that any slave culture, molestation was commonplace. It was rampant because since the slaves were treated as nothing more than personal property, no one could tell you what you could do with your slave. You wanted to beat your slave, you beat him. If you wanted to make them do menial labor, you made them do menial labor. You could make them do whatever you wanted because they were slaves. You had to feed them. They technically had, I'm talking about in America, they technically had some type of rights. You couldn't kill them, but who was going to enforce those rights? Was there any watchdog? Was there any policing? Not really. Not really. Because the entire society was a slave society that encouraged slavery and did not want the slaves to gain any kind of freedom or have any sense of freedom. And it was the entire system, from the master on up to the government, to the police, everything was completely there to maintain the slave society. That was true when we were in Egypt as well. We didn't have any rights. They could do as they pleased with us. The fact is that the Egyptians did not molest the Jewish women, but that was a miracle. That was because God protected the Jewish women. In any slave society, the women are molested. There is no way to avoid that because there's no policing and there's no watchdog. No one's looking over anybody else's shoulder. So if you just put women under the control of other people, that's what's going to happen. In our society, in the Jewish society, even when we had non-Jewish slaves, there was policing and there was oversight because it wasn't a question of practicality. It wasn't a monetary question. It wasn't a question of a societal behavior that we were looking for. It was the law in the Torah for which we punished, like any other law in the Torah. And the non-Jewish women slaves were off limits. The exception was only if you purchased a Jewish slave, as we learned before, and that Jewish slave had been married, was married, is married, when he comes into your care, you are allowed to pair him off with a non-Jewish maid. That is permitted to be done. But that's not a situation of taking advantage. That is the purpose. It's a clear purpose in order to, they live together as if they were husband and wife, they produce children, etc. But the master, who's the one who has the control, is prohibited from any kind of action like that. And again, this is a sharp departure from the concept of slavery that we are all familiar with. So we are showing a sharp departure both in the treatment of the slaves in how one can handle them in terms of getting them to do what you want them to do. If they don't, let's say the slave doesn't listen, you can't beat them. You can take them to court. The court could punish, but the court could punish anybody for anything. But you can't go and, you know, you can tell them you have to do what you know. And also when it comes to molestation, that was not done because it was something that was policed. It was something that was watched out for. A Jewish slave and a Jewish maid, that there's no reason for today's society to be any different than that. Because really, those arrangements are much closer to an employee, than a slave. It's a whole different type of thing. Or a foster care. It's just a different way of phrasing it, a different way of setting up the money, but that's really what it is. With the non-Jewish slaves, So you had asked this last time, and I don't know the answer to the question, what happens in the future when Mashiach does come and we have a government set up in Israel with a temple, with a king that follows the laws of the Torah? So then what will happen to the laws of slavery with non-Jews? Is there going to be an institution of non-Jews as slaves to Jews? That's a fair question. What you're asking is, do those laws only apply when the world at large is involved in slavery, or are they inherently going to be true later? Which is a fair question. I don't know the answer, but we should bear in mind that slavery is alive and well today as well, unfortunately. Not in our society, but it does go on in the world. So which part of the world is going to be the dominant part of the world at that time? I don't know. I don't know. I hope people will be enlightened. I hope they'll be right. So I don't know what it's going to be like. But it does still go on. Unfortunately, it is a terrible thing, and it does happen. That's number one. Number two, as I mentioned to you last time, the primary source of non-Jewish slaves was the POW, the prisoner of war, because when you have one nation attacks another nation, and then you have all these able-bodied men who are captured, who are perfectly healthy, what do you do with them? If you repatriate them, then the logical thing to do is to rejoin the army and fight again. Right? That's why in Israel today, what do you do with those terrorists that are locked up? And if you just return them, they're going to be terrorists again. What have we gained? Right? So what do you do? So you got to keep them, and you got to feed them, right? What do you do? So if you live in a barbaric Arab society, then you execute them. That's what you do. Right? That's what they do. Which is why we Jews, if we weren't the moral people that we are, we would say, that's what they would do, so we may as well do the same thing. But we are of a higher caliber, right? We hold ourselves to a higher standard. We acknowledge that we're not animals like they are, and therefore we don't do that. But what do you do with them? What do you do with them? So the Torah says, you'll care for them, you'll feed them, and you'll give them clothing, you'll give them shelter, but not for free. They're going to work. They attacked you, and now they're going to be your slave. That's all. And they will live their lives with clothing, with shelter, with food, and they'll work. That's what they'll do. You cannot beat them. You cannot molest them. But they'll work for you. That's where slavery finds expression in the Torah. So now when you ask, what about in the future? I don't know if they're going to be POWs. You know, there's not supposed to be any war anymore. There is war in the bringing of Mashiach. But then once I don't know what society is going to look like. But if you ask me, it's not a bad idea. I don't mean for the future. I mean the whole concept, what do you do with a POW? To me, it makes a lot of sense. To me, it makes sense.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. He does not make money off the site, but he does need money in order to run the site. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.